It's the Burt Cohen Show. You know, people say America as if it's just these currently United States, but there's Central America as well as South America, and pretty much, you know, everybody wants the same thing, not to live in abject poverty, but to have enough to eat, to have a few other things as well, to have some freedom, to have health care, things like that, and you know, for a couple hundred years or so, the U.S. saw Central and South America as our backyard. Can you imagine our backyard? They're nobody's backyard. They're independent. You know, they're themselves. They want to determine their own future and have self-determination. And there's been a heck of a lot of imperialism through the years. CIA in Guatemala in 1954. Didn't like the government there, so we overthrew it. Chile, September 11, 1973, when Henry Kissinger and his buddies at AT&T overthrew the legitimately elected government. Well, a lot's been happening in Central and South America in these recent years. It may not have made as much American media, but it's moving. It's moving a lot. And I want to find out today, you're going to find out by listening, what's happening down there, why it's happened there, and how it's happening. It seems to be moving both left and forward for the most part. Burt Cohen here. It's the Burt Cohen Show. Our guest today, I'm very pleased, down in Puerto Rico, where the weather is actually okay today. We were a little concerned. Carmela Ruiz Marrero is a Puerto Rican author, journalist, and environmental educator. He's also a research associate for the Institute of Social Ecology. Mr. Ruiz, thank you for being with us. Earlier this summer, there was a meeting in Caracas, Venezuela, of many left-leaning groups. I wonder if you could tell us what the purpose of that meeting, that forum, was.
It was the 18th encounter of the Foro de Sao Paulo, which is an organization that brings together the majority of the Latin American left. And this organization has existed for the last 20 years, and it's been growing and growing. In fact, a number of the organizations, leftist parties that founded it in 1990, are now in power. For example, the Workers' Party in Brazil was the prime mover behind the formation of the Foro, and they were an opposition party back then. As of now, they have won 3 presidential elections in a row. And you also have other organizations which are also now in power. For example, in El Salvador, the former guerrillas, the FMLN, just won a couple of years ago the presidential elections, and they were part of the Foro de Sao Paulo. Also the Sandinistas, which yes, were elected right back into power. You know, Daniel Ortega is the president again. And also parties that are now in power in Uruguay, Ecuador, and Venezuela. And there was an air of optimism, in spite of all the dangers, that we have come a pretty long way from what things used to be in 1990, 91, which were pretty awful years for progressive thinking. And there's many challenges ahead. It was for me an absolutely amazing experience to be able to share with all of these people from all of these countries at once. From all over the hemisphere, there were people from the left, from Barbados, Haiti, Dominican Republic, Panama, Costa Rica, plus also observers and dignitaries from Russia, China, Vietnam, Palestine, Lebanon, Greece, the Basque Country, the Canary Islands, Catalonia in Spain, as well as France. Nobel Peace Prize laureate Rigoberta Menchú from Guatemala was also there. President Hugo Chavez hosted us. He spent a little time with us at the very end of the activity for the formal closing ceremony. And many resolutions were approved there, including support for the release of Puerto Rican political prisoner Oscar Lopez, which is a campaign that I'm very active with, and a repudiation of the right-wing media assault against progressive movements and governments. I mean, if you think Bill O'Reilly and Glenn Beck are bad, you should see what's on the right-wing media in places like Venezuela and Ecuador, just so-called journalists and editors openly calling for the overthrow of the government. And
wow.
It's pretty much a concerted offensive. Many other subjects were dealt with. There were a number of tables. I participated in the one on food security. And many, many other subjects were dealt with formally as well as informally.
Well, you covered a lot of ground really quickly there. And it sounds like there is, you know, some degree of freedom of the press in that the right wing can be so virulent against President Chavez of Venezuela. Before we go too far, you said things were pretty rough in 1990 and 91. Now, here, you know, I remember the Reagan years where the U.S. supported the Contra thug in Nicaragua and supported the brutal fascist government of El Salvador. But that was, you know, in the 80s. Tell us about 1990-91. What was it like there? Why was it so tough?
Well, one thing is that to a certain extent that Reagan counterinsurgency, which was especially brutal and genocidal in Guatemala and in El Salvador and took many lives also in Nicaragua. I mean, at least 200,000 dead just in Central America, to say nothing, of course, of the dictatorships in South America. By then, that policy, in a sense, had pretty much had the desired effect. The left had been slaughtered, pulverized, massacred. In the case of Argentina, people had been tortured, killed, disemboweled, thrown off helicopters into the sea so that their bodies would never be seen again. And much of the left, you know, intellectuals, union leaders, campesino organizers, students, professors, had either been killed or were in exile, mostly in Europe. So in that sense, they pretty much achieved their objective. Once these countries moved into formal democracy, much of the left had been demoralized, fragmented, slaughtered, driven to exile. And it was then the right time, you know, a left that was basically exhausted. That was the right time to start pushing in neoliberal reforms, together with the move towards a formal democracy, so that neoliberalism could be associated with democracy and vice versa. But there was no mood to engage in an armed struggle or militant anything at the time when we were just barely beginning to count the dead. So, yeah, they were very difficult times. Plus, also remember, much of the left was dealing with crisis, for example, the implosion of the Soviet Union, the collapse of the Eastern Bloc, which many in the left saw as a hope, you know, as a counterweight against U.S. imperialism. But many people interpreted the end of communism in Eastern Europe and the Soviet Union as they interpreted that as the end of any progressive thinking, the end of the aspiration to move toward anything other than capitalism, that socialism was dead and that it was a nice idea, but we have to move on. And from now on, all we can look forward to is an amicable capitalism based on corporate social responsibility, private volunteerism. So it was pretty awful. It was a very, very difficult time. And our adversaries knew it, that they moved very fast to introduce free trade agreements and neoliberal reforms and breakneck privatization.
We are talking on the Bert Cohen Show with Carmelo Ruiz Marrero about what's going on in Central and South America, moving left and forward. Now, certainly, my impression has been that the traditional economic structure has been a few very wealthy families running a lot of countries, basically owning everything and running the country. And I know, you know, that was the case in Nicaragua and El Salvador, where there were certain families. But what is the situation now? It has not traditionally been, correct me if I'm wrong, There has not traditionally been a large middle class participating in the economy. It's been, you know, a very few very wealthy people and a whole bunch of really poor people. Is there a middle class? Is this something that's new? And are they aligned with the leftward trend as well?
Well, there's very you're right. There's very little middle class in Latin America. The extremes of wealth are probably the most extreme in the world, especially in cases like Brazil, Paraguay, Nicaragua, Haiti. There is something of a middle class, but it's not, you know, proportionally as large as you would find in a country like the United States or England. In the case of Brazil, the progressive reforms by the Workers' Party over the last decade or so has made that middle class larger, as opposed to the United States, where it is disappearing and being driven off a cliff. That's actually a rare success story, but there's also Uruguay, where the overall standard of living for most of the population has been improving under the leftist government of the Frente Amplio, which has won the second presidential election in a row. They have now a former guerrilla, Pepe Mujica, a man who engaged in armed struggle against the dictatorship, was captured and tortured, and now he's the president. And there's a few success stories here and there, but overall, as far as economic equality is concerned, there's still an awful lot of work to do, a very long way to go. You're dealing with very violent ruling classes mm-hmm. who would engage in an armed revolt over just about any issue. Remember the president of 1973.
Yes.
The CIA-funded overthrow of Salvador Allende.
Yes.
That's on everybody's mind. This is why many of the progressive leaders in these countries are reluctant to move quickly in the way of redistributing wealth and land and livelihood to working people. You saw what happened in Paraguay only a month or two ago, where President Lugo, that could barely be called a leftist, he was just basically slightly left of center, and that was too much for the ruling class in Paraguay, and they staged a revolt against him.
Really?
The ruling classes have also recently tried it in Venezuela in 2002,
yes.
More recently in Bolivia and Ecuador. So if the leftist governments haven't moved far and fast enough in redistributing wealth, it's precisely because of fear that a repeat of Chile in 1973 might happen.
Yes, and for those who may not remember, the first disaster on September 11th, 1973, when Henry Kissinger and his CIA buddies with AT&T, Anaconda Copper, had a violent, horrible overthrow of the legitimate government of Salvador Allende, and lots and lots and lots of people were massacred and disappeared. And I can imagine, you know, fear is, in fact, a motivating factor in politics. It's certainly a good point. You want to do the right thing, but the wealthy interests have an awful lot of power, and with that is guns and weapons. And, you know, people like to keep their blood inside their bodies, basically.
Right.
And I wonder, one of the things that I remember, a few years ago, I believe George W. Bush was still president, and I remember Evo Morales came into power in Bolivia, and I remember talking to somebody at the time and wondering how much of a factor George W. Bush was in Morales' victory. Tell us a little bit about that. I thought that was, from what little I know in Bolivia, there's a lot of resources there that are important to you know, the corporate interests, some natural gas and things like that. And yet there are a lot of First Nation people, indigenous people, and Evo Morales is among that group. Tell us a bit about Bolivia and how Morales got into power and how they're doing against the some powerful interests.
Well, that is a very remarkable story. Bolivia, over the centuries, has given out wealth, tons of wealth, to Europe, mainly to Spain. They had literally mountains of silver. All that silver is gone. All of it went to Spain, and eventually all that ended up in Swiss banks and Well, anyway, after they took the silver, then they took, and they're still taking the tin, which is another mineral that has made some people rich in the 20th century. And much of that is gone already. And the patience of the Bolivian people, who have always been resisting, that patience pretty much ran out when the neoliberal government intended to give away the water to the San Francisco-based Bechtel Corporation through a process that was overseen by the World Bank, privatization of the water, and then give away the gas, because Bolivia has huge reserves of natural gas, and it was basically being given away to foreign corporations. And that caused the people's revolt, the water war and the gas war, in which people just left their houses and slums and paralyzed the country and slugged it out with the police and the army until the country couldn't be governed. And two presidents in a row were forced to just run for it and go to the airport and leave.
Wow.
Or face charges of treason. So the Bolivians were able at that point, this was, I believe, less than 10 years ago, were able to refound the country. And the strongest grassroots movement was the movement towards socialism, the Spanish initials, MAS, which was basically led by coca growers. Now, coca has been grown centuries before cocaine even existed.
Of course.
You know, it's given a lot of different uses, medicinal, food, and it's a very delicate plant that grows in very, very few places in the world. And many people have been forced into that when everything was privatized and major industries like mining were almost completely shut down. They were able to do this because the big plantations, the latifundios, had been abolished in a revolution back in 1952. So this is a big group of small growers, and they won the election, two elections in a row, and were able to put their leader, Evo Morales, in power. Now, this is the first time a native person, a non-European,
yes,
becomes the president of Bolivia, which is a country that whose the majority of the population is indigenous. I don't want to use the word Indian because,
right,
well, Indians are from India, and it can be a pretty confusing term.
Yeah.
So you have now a president that actually represents the majority of the people. Morales is facing major contradictions because natural resources generate a lot of money,
yes,
with which you can pay for social programs, which Bolivia has now, pensions for the old, financial assistance for families with young children. All these programs are pretty popular. And Bolivia, even though Evo Morales is the one president in the world who gets it about global warming, you know, he's taken a world leadership role in getting people and governments to take action. But the sad truth is that Bolivia depends on exports of oil and natural gas.
Right.
And to say nothing of the large-scale mining operations, there's copper and other important minerals, and now there's the lithium rush.
Yeah.
Lithium is a mineral that is available in salt flats, like the ones in Bolivia and Chile in the deserts, and that mineral is absolutely necessary for the rechargeable battery.
Right.
You know, we're talking iPhones, Blackberries, electric cars, and so now there's a lithium rush going on.
Oh, my.
And so there, the whole stage is being set for a major confrontation with grassroots organizations that are a little bit tired of this type of thing going on, you know, large-scale natural resource extraction. The government of Evo Morales has already said that they will dig for oil in the Amazon, and they're not willing to discuss it. It's not negotiable. And you may have heard the big conflict over the Amazonian highway slashing across the lowlands of Bolivia, the so-called Pitney's Highway, which is also going to be used by major resource extraction companies, and many native peoples are opposed to it.
Mm.
So we see major conflict coming up in Bolivia regarding the use of natural resources in the very near future.
Well, I imagine one of the big questions is, my understanding is the natural resources in the past have been traditionally owned and controlled by a few powerful interests. And now, tell me if this is accurate. It seems that Evo Morales, the president, wants to take that money and use it to benefit the large majority of the people, the indigenous people, and that's really the big difference. And I understand there's different regions of the country, and you know, his power is not without resistance from the powerful, wealthy right wing, yes?
One of the characteristics, you know, concrete features of this new progressive government is that the government is much more involved in economic activity than under the previous neoliberal governments. In the neoliberal governments, like Sanchez de Lozada in Bolivia, right before Evo Morales, the private sector and foreigners were pretty much in control of everything regarding the exploitation of natural resources. That has changed very much, you know, in countries like Brazil, Bolivia, Venezuela, of course, and Ecuador. And with this greater participation, they've been getting much greater revenues from their own natural resources. And a large amount of that has been channeled into very popular public assistance programs. Uh-huh. So and quite a number of the poor in Bolivia and other countries with progressive governments are seeing benefits that they had never seen before. So these programs are pretty popular. And for that, you have to keep up the exploitation of natural resources.
Right.
And also, things have changed since the previous decade and the neoliberal period. For example, there is the Brazil factor. Brazil owns a lot of the oil wells in Bolivia. In fact, when Evo nationalized oil, it was not the U.S. who objected first. It was Brazil. The Foreign Relations Ministry immediately launched a warning, and President Lula of the Workers' Party went there in person to Bolivia to ask what the hell was going on. Eventually, they reached an agreement, and, you know, they made up. But also, Brazilian companies are very much interested in gaining access to Bolivia's resources. And Brazil is a country that is bent on expansion. They have already stated that their legitimate interests stretch across the Atlantic all the way to the African coast. I would never have believed that if I hadn't read it myself.
Wow.
Plus, they also want access to the Pacific Ocean in order to have closer access to the big markets in China. And for that, they and other Latin American countries are building a huge public infrastructure that cuts across the Andes Mountains.
Wow.
So that you can send raw materials like oil and soy on these highways across the Andes to ports in Peru, Ecuador, Chile, and be able to get to the big markets in China faster. China is a big factor now.
Uh-huh.
China is beginning to become one of the biggest trading partners of Latin America. And many governments are seeing China as an alternative to the United States.
Hmm.
In fact, China would never have achieved its economic miracle. We have raw materials from Latin America. We have the oil, iron ore, and other resources. So it's a new, more complex panorama. There's a lot of study that needs to be done as to the China-Latin America relationship. And that's very important in order to figure out strategies to fight global warming and others. But it's really a brave new world that we're entering now. Not that the U.S. is not significant anymore. It is still pretty much there, and the U.S. will remain a powerful presence in Latin America for the foreseeable future.
We are talking with my guest today, Carmelo Ruiz Marrero, Puerto Rican author, journalist, environmental educator, real research associates of the Institute of Social Ecology, about Latin America. And it does seem like the U.S. kind of may be missing the boat, that we've seen so many situations where a blatant, violent, imperialist, colonialist occupier loses in the long run. And it seems like China is the beneficiary of that. And I wonder how, well, there's so much to talk about here, how the U.S. might improve things. Is there any change since Obama came in? I mean, I noticed in Honduras there's been the violent overthrow of a legitimate government under Obama's watch, and he seemed to accept that pretty clearly. Is there any significant change that might benefit the U.S., or is it pretty much business as usual?
Well, Latin Americans had big hopes in 2008. You know, Latin Americans from all political stripes, especially the left, were pretty happy to see Bush go and McCain lose the election. There was a lot of expectation that Obama would bring a new era in relations with Latin America and with the Latino community in the U.S., and that didn't come to pass. People all over Latin America are looking closely to what is happening to Latinos in the U.S., and Obama has deported more immigrants, mainly Latinos, than the previous presidents. And, you know, that doesn't bode well for him with the Latino community in the upcoming elections. And, well, I think he knows that. But overall, people are pretty disappointed. If you look at the declarations of the Foro de Sao Paulo, the general mood is that nothing has changed, that this is not up to a single person, a single chief of state. But so far, yeah, the relations have been pretty confrontational. Under Obama, we've seen coup d'etats against elected governments in Paraguay and Honduras, and also an attempt in Ecuador, and also the belligerent attitude towards Venezuela, you know, funding all kinds of opposition groups, belligerent declarations against Venezuela. They don't bode well at all. But I think people also know that with Romney, it would be even more unapologetic and worse.
Oh, yeah.
But it's overall, it's been a pretty big disappointment. Like I said, there were very, very high expectations in Latin America regarding him.
Yeah, well, here too. And I remember during the 08 election when the slogan was hope. Of course, when you raise hopes, guess what? There's going to be disappointment. And he raised hopes tremendously. And there's been a lot of disappointment for very, very legitimate reasons. And, you know, people are there's nowhere near the enthusiasm for Obama that there was in 2008. And you talk about, you know, I wonder, of course, where the real power is. You know, there's the royal or not royal aristocratic, powerful families that have ruled many of these countries. And you use the word neoliberal a number of times. It's not a phrase people understand very well. Does that have to do with the influence of the World Bank and the IMF? What does all that neoliberalism mean? And I wonder if you could just go into that a little bit first.
Sure. And neoliberal is a pretty problematic word, you know. The term was come up with at the end of the Cold War in order to give a very nice and user-friendly packaging to the new series of awful economic measures that were going to be imposed. Now, the term liberal is very problematic because what is known as liberalism, economic liberalism in Latin America, is known as conservatism in the U.S.
Yes.
So what neoliberal means in Latin America is the same as neoconservative in the U.S. I know it's crazy. I acknowledge that the terminology is problematic. In the U.S., the correct term is neoconservatism. And basically, it's an ideology that was come up with to associate democracy with free markets and corporate control and make them all the same thing, and to baffle and demoralize the progressive forces. How can it be? We're moving towards a democracy. The dictatorships have ended and the big wars funded by the CIA, all of that is stuff of the past. We're moving towards democracy and formal freedom of speech, representative parliament, and universal suffrage, and yet things are getting worse than ever, and there's more corporate control than ever. And it was basically, in short, neoliberalism is an ideology that is meant to equate democracy with corporate control.
Yeah.
And to tell you, well, it's been pretty much discredited all over Latin America. We've seen neoliberal governments lose elections or get overthrown. But still, you know, it still has a hold. We still have plenty of right-wing governments in Latin America. For example, Colombia and Mexico, which are the worst. But there's also, you know, Costa Rica and the post-coup Paraguay and Haiti. The right wing is back in power in Chile. But anyway, that's basically what neoliberalism is all about. It's been pretty much discredited, but it refuses to give up.
Yeah, interesting here how people, an awful lot of people in these currently United States, believe that democracy and a republic means corporate ownership, corporate control. And it's not. It's supposed to be, self-government and government of, by, and for the people, not by the big, powerful corporations. So we share a lot of things. The people, there used to be a large middle class in the United States, but these same forces that have been operating quite freely and powerfully in Latin America are operating here, too. So tell us about the influence of the World Bank and the IMF. My understanding is that they say they're there to help develop undeveloped countries that need their help, need their capital to come in. What has been the effect of the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund?
Well, they're both very important institutions if you want to figure out why things have gone the way they have. They basically, during the years of the Cold War, we're talking 50s and 60s, the World Bank offered loans, pretty bad loans, to third world countries, for example, in Latin America, for many projects that would have never been underwritten by private enterprise, super mega projects that changed, transformed the economies of countries. We're talking mega hydro dams, super highways, power generation projects, a lot of them misconceived and misplaced. And the worst part of it is that these countries, like in Latin America, ended up with an awful lot of debt. And that debt kept increasing and increasing. Just imagine the World Bank is the loan shark. The IMF is the thug that rearranges your face and breaks your bones when you don't pay. Well, that's what the IMF has done to these countries. When they're in desperate economic straits, the IMF, which is, I think it's basically across the street from the World Bank in Washington, they offer a package of emergency loans, not tied to any particular development project, but just for the country's treasury to get it out of dire straits. But these loans are conditioned, and the conditions are pretty awful. Basically, you have to open up your markets no matter what the impact is to local industries. Privatization across the board, health, education, drastic government cutbacks to everything except to the military, of course. And basically, what these conditionalities do is to cripple the country economically over the short and long term. And this usually provokes riots like the ones in Venezuela and the Dominican Republic in 1989, and also in Jamaica at about that time. They called them IMF riots. And in fact, in Venezuela, it was a slaughter. That was 1989, El Caracazo, which was a key factor in bringing Hugo Chavez to power a decade later. But anyway, that's a long story. In 1994 was the 50th anniversary of these institutions. And there was a big, powerful campaign, very strong in the United States, the 50 Years is Enough campaign, which aimed to educate everybody about all the awful things these institutions have done. And anyway, they're still powerful, but not as much as before. For example, to give you just one important fact, Brazil was able to pay off the IMF. They no longer owe any money. Under the government of Lula, they were able to get control of, increase the revenues they were getting from natural resources exploitation, and were able to use that to pay off the IMF and send it home. Now Brazil is a creditor. Brazil began its new relationship with the IMF by giving a $50 billion donation. That's not a third world country anymore. Now Brazil is a creditor nation. Now when capitalism is in trouble, they go to, among other places, Brazil. And other countries are being able to pay off their foreign debt by revenues from petroleum. I believe that was the case with Venezuela and Ecuador. Right now, Brazil's government development bank, the BNDES, is larger than the World Bank. That government-run bank in Brazil is lending out $100 million a year.
Wow.
They're not only, they are using basically labor union pension funds and taxpayers' money, revenues from soy and oil and iron ore, and they're using this to pay for their own economic development. Not only their own, but that of other countries. Bolivia and Ecuador are getting an awful lot of financing from this Brazilian bank.
So are they?
Yeah, it is important to know what the IMF and the World Bank are doing,
yeah.
But also the players are changing.
Interesting.
Like
so,
I said.
So is Brazil being more, shall we say, humane than the IMF and the World Bank in their lending?
I'm not sure. Yeah. I think so. You know, basically the finances are run by the Workers' Party, which is heading the coalition that is running the government. So we have a lot of people from the left now managing these institutions.
Uh-huh.
And there is an awful lot of public sector involvement. Like I said, you know, some money from labor unions and the public sector. But in the end, you know, they're also funding a lot of stuff that is unsustainable. And an increasing number of activist groups have been paying attention to unsustainable projects funded by BNDES. For example, the Belo Monte Dam, which is one of the world's biggest dams, being built right in the middle of the rainforest.
Oh, my.
And, you know, place populated by indigenous peoples, and is totally going to disrupt the ecosystem upstream and downstream. You may wonder why you need to generate huge amounts of electricity in the middle of nowhere.
Yes.
And the real object of that is to facilitate mining and smelting.
Uh-huh.
Because there's still a big natural resource rush going on. There's tons of unexploited mineral resources in very faraway places, resources that had not been exploited because there weren't the highways and transportation infrastructure that exists today. And this will lead to a major confrontation with native peoples. So,
right.
Yes, the World Bank and the IMF have to be watched, but now we have major players like Brazil's Development Bank, and let's not forget Chinese corporations. Some of the largest corporations, oil corporations in the world, are either Chinese or Brazilian. Vale, which is a Brazilian corporation, is the world's second mining corporation. I believe it's larger than Rio Tinto, and it was founded by the government of Brazil. The world's second largest oil corporation is Petrobras, the Brazilian oil company,
right.
Which was also founded by the government of Brazil. And these corporations that I mentioned have operations all over the world. So yeah, it's not necessarily more humane. It just presents a more complex panorama as we entered an Asian century.
Wow. You are listening to The Bert Cohen Show, exploring Latin America, the political and economic realities way south of our border. You know, one of the people that's been in the news, the neoconservative movement here, the neocons, demonized Hugo Chavez of Venezuela. And I had the amazing pleasure to see a movie, Carmelo, I'm not sure if you've seen it, about the revolution not being televised. And it had the attempted coup live.
Oh, yeah, yes. It was shown in Puerto Rico. Totally amazing.
Amazing stuff. Just the luck of these camera people was amazing there. What, you know, the Republicans demonize Hugo Chavez, and I hear, frankly, not such good things about him these days with regard to freedom of the press and stuff like that. Is his popularity still strong? Is he becoming more dictatorial? What is the reality, as you see it, of Venezuela and Hugo Chavez?
Well, when I spent some time there this summer, I was able to see it for myself. He's been constantly elected and reelected since 1999. He's lost only one electoral event, and that was maybe 5 years ago when he tried to ram through too many constitutional amendments at once, and people got cold feet, and they sent him the message that they wanted to go slower with the constitutional reforms. I think it was something like 60 amendments at once.
Wow.
But other than that event, he's been, for example, the right wing tried to do a recall referendum, which I believe that was done in California a number of years back.
Indeed it was, successfully.
The whole thing blew up in their face. Hugo Chavez accepted the challenge and got reelected. And now the next presidential elections are coming up in October. I arrived in the country just as the official electoral season began. And right now it's pretty obvious that Chavez will win again. The danger is that the right wing will not accept the election results.
Uh-oh.
They'll think of something. But according to the leaders in the Foro de Sao Paulo, we have to watch that very closely because the right wing is getting ready to refuse to acknowledge the results. Now, you have to see who Hugo is running against. He's running against a right-wing thug, a man who should be in bars. I mean, his name is Capriles. His last name is Capriles Radonsky. That guy is lucky I'm not the president of Venezuela. I would have that guy behind bars if it were me. That guy tried, and you can see the video evidence, I'm sure it's on YouTube, that man tried to storm the Cuban embassy in Caracas during the coup 10 years ago, much like England is trying to do with the Ecuadorian embassy in London, except this time it was not a government, it was a mob, a right-wing mob that just wanted to ransack the embassy because they that some of the government's leaders had sought refuge there. But, you know, having been the vice president of Venezuela or having had a high government post in the Hugo Chavez government, that's not a crime in itself. This was during the coup that is narrated in that movie, The Revolution Will Not Be Televised. And the man had a right-wing mob with him, and there were children inside the Cuban embassy. There was civilian personnel. And basically, he was trying to ram it through. He didn't get away with it. But, you know, if you try to storm an embassy, that's a violation of international law. There is the Vienna Convention that stipulates that the embassies and their personnel are not to be touched.
Right.
But anyway, this is the guy who's running against Chavez. He's his platform is totally pro-U.S., unabashed, right-wing. The previous leader of the right was Carmona, who led the coup d'etat and basically had to run away when the coup got nowhere.
Right.
It is a very centralized government, absolutely. And some in the left are having mixed feelings about him. They do support him. You know, for example, the Communist Party supports the government, but they still have a separate structure. You know, they're basically keeping an arm's-length relationship. They will close ranks with him if the right wing tries anything funny.
Sure.
You know, they're not too sectarian.
Right.
And basically, he comes from the military. This is why a lot of people in the left, in and out of Venezuela, didn't support him at first because, you know, it brought the memories of Pinochet and Hugo Banzer in Bolivia. So they were quite leery about it. But he did win the election back in, I believe, 99, and little by little he's been getting support and acceptance from the left, but it wasn't always that way. Large numbers of people, especially in the city of Caracas, have seen their standard of living improve.
Uh-huh.
Many of the old, well, actually not old, though, shanty towns around Caracas now have pavement. They don't have dirt roads anymore. They have running water and electricity.
Wow.
And this has motivated a lot of people to go ahead and keep supporting Chavez. But the best evidence that he has the support of the people is on that movie, The Revolution Won't Be Televised, because what the right wing tried in 2002 was basically a repeat of Chile in 1973.
Yes.
They had everything from the business class, religious leaders, traitors, generals, but they weren't counting on one thing. And that was the majority of the people of Caracas, hundreds of thousands of people who came down from the slums out in the hills, hundreds of thousands, maybe over a million of them, willing to give their lives and to face the army and the traitors. And they were determined that Chile in 1973 would not happen again, not in Caracas.
Mm.
And this is what keeps Hugo Chavez in power, the support of maybe 1 million strong people who are willing to storm the capital if there is ever another coup d'etat. So you have a lot of people there making sure that the Chile scenario is not repeated again. Now that the right wing sees that they cannot try the Pinochet route again, they're doing their offensive through the media, disinforming, threatening, alarming people, and basically hiding behind freedom of speech to do their disruptive work.
Sounds like Fox Network. And I was reminded of that, actually, while watching that movie, which obviously we both recommend to people, The Revolution Will Not Be Televised, an incredible documentary. We are talking, Bert Cohen here. Our guest today is Carmelo Ruiz Marrero. And you mentioned Ecuador and the Ecuadorian embassy in London. Very interesting situation there right now. Julian Assange, a name most people seem to know here in America these days, the guy behind WikiLeaks who dared to reveal the truth about American foreign policy. The U.S. wants him very, very badly because they don't like the truth being told, even though Obama said he'd have more of a transparent administration. Huh, hasn't exactly happened. Tell us, why does Ecuador interested in and happy to give Julian Assange amnesty and sanctuary?
I don't know. maybe it was Assange's initiative. You know, he was picking a country that would be most likely to accept a plea for sanctuary, and he picked Ecuador. Ecuador, as a matter of fact, Ecuador benefited, was affected an awful lot by the WikiLeaks disclosures.
Oh, really?
They were basically an X-ray of U.S.-Ecuador relations.
Ah.
They showed who the U.S. was supporting in the Ecuadorian opposition. Basically, it's going to be years before we get an accurate assessment of how WikiLeaks has affected Latin America's relations with the U.S. Those revelations were a total smash. And especially the U.S. embassy in Ecuador was totally naked. They were totally embarrassed because they provided a very accurate picture of the blatant interventionism of the U.S. in the internal affairs of that country. So maybe there is a debt of gratitude on the part of Ecuador.
Oh.
And I was in Caracas, you know, in the Foro de Sao Paulo meeting. One of the things that we accorded is not in the final declaration of Caracas. It was a separate resolution. The people present, you know, from all of these countries voted for a request to the Ecuadorian government to give Assange asylum. And right there in Caracas, the head of the Ecuadorian declaration of the delegation was precisely Patiño, the foreign minister of Ecuador. So he was there and he received that request in person. So I hope that we in the Foro de Sao Paulo were a significant part of getting Ecuador to accept this request for Julian Assange. And if you watch the Latin American media, like Telesur in Venezuela and other progressive media, you'll see that the WikiLeaks case is headline news all over, not just in Venezuela, but all over. Everybody is commenting it, being very supportive of Ecuador's position, even from people who are not generally in the left have been pretty supportive. So it's been a factor of unity.
Yeah, it's
Latin American governments.
It's amazing to me how, you know, obvious it is that if you have a powerful militaristic interest coming in and controlling your country, of course it's going to unite people. It's going to bring people together, even though they may disagree on things. And it seems so obvious that has been happening and uniting, you know, various factions within the left. And my old friend Abby Hoffman used to say that, the relationship between the right and left is perfect. The right is sadistic. The left tends to be masochistic, you know, fighting amongst ourselves, you know. But it seems, I mean, that's a great way to unify people. What is happening in Honduras? I was very disturbed to see it was barely to the left. Was it? I don't even know if it was to the left at all. The government of Honduras there. Is the left uniting against this military coup that happened just a couple of years ago?
Well, we had some Honduran visitors in Puerto Rico, and they were hosted by the local Socialist Front and other organizations, and I met them. We were able to ask them a few things about, you know, what on earth has been going on there.
Yeah.
You know, give us a report from the ground, because the president, Zelaya, that was overthrown,
right,
wasn't really that much of a leftist,
right,
in the first place. One of the things Zelaya told the left, you know, after the coup, is that the trouble began shortly after he got elected, when people from the U.S. Embassy came over to him with a list of people that they wanted to see in his cabinet.
Yeah.
And he said, screw that, you know, I'm the one who decides here. I was elected by the people, and, you know, I can't have a foreign government giving me a laundry list of things to do.
Right.
That's when the trouble began. And as soon as the right wing began to corner him, he realized that the progressive organizations on the left were his natural allies. And before such an alliance could be concerted, he was overthrown. And it's been pretty violent. I don't know, I think something like 20 journalists, I don't know the exact number, have been murdered.
Yes.
In the years after the coup. And just think about it. I mean, the U.S. raises a stink about freedom of the press in Venezuela, but I haven't heard of any journalists who have been imprisoned or killed or anything in Venezuela. Meanwhile, in Honduras, you have over a dozen journalists already killed, not to mention all the peasant leaders that are fighting bitter land struggles, fighting against the expansion of biofuel plantations and such, that have been killed or driven underground. So the resistance is there. I understand some elections are coming up, and Zelaya is thinking of a bid for the presidency again.
Yes.
Lugo is doing the same thing in Paraguay, waiting for the next election. And other than that, we don't have that many news
out of Honduras.
From Honduras. But the resistance is there. People are not giving up.
I'm sure.
They know that they live under an illegitimate regime brought
yes.
about by a coup d'etat.
Yes.
And they're not forgetting about that.
Well, talk about
solidify the unity of Latin America to make a pariah of that government.
Yes.
And the same goes for the illegitimate government in Paraguay. Very similar story.
Well, there's a real legitimate government, it seems to me. I don't know much about the situation in El Salvador, a place where Ronald Reagan and the CIA worked very successfully to crush the nationalistic self-control aspirations of the people of El Salvador. But the FMLN, the guerrillas, fought the war to a stalemate, and they are in power now. How are things in El Salvador? Is the economy improving there? Is there a better life for the people of El Salvador now?
Well, in El Salvador, is pretty complicated. There were very complex negotiations at the end of the war in the early 90s, to allow the new government would need legitimacy, which meant allowing people from the FMLN back into the political process legally.
Right.
A number of years ago, they won many seats in the legislature, and more recently they were able to win presidential elections. But of course, things are not the same anymore. There isn't that much room to maneuver because the right wing is there. And, you know, the right wing in El Salvador is particularly violent. So power has meant, as it always does when the left comes to power, power means a lot of compromises, contradictions, and responsibilities. And, you know, you could say that the FMLN now is not the same as in the 1980s when they were underground.
Yeah.
I don't doubt that some of the people there and in other countries, particular militants from the left, have been seduced by the trappings of power and have softened their line. And there's many that are still speaking a leftist talk but are really not walking their talk. In the case of El Salvador, the FMLN chose Mr. Funes. Now, Funes has not historically been an FMLN militant. They picked him from outside the ranks because he was a popular TV show host.
Yeah.
And there are people in the FMLN grassroots who are not happy with it, that, we need somebody who is ideologically from the left and risen from the ranks, because, well, some people in the FMLN are really not happy with all the compromising that he has sought to make and have said, you see, it wasn't a good idea. We have to raise somebody from the ranks, not bring a TV show host here, no matter how popular he is. Elections will be coming up soon in El Salvador. I don't know exactly when, But the people in the grassroots of MLN want somebody else. I'm not sure if you can run for president more than once as an incumbent. So so right now they're pressuring to have somebody else run. But it is very interesting. Many of the people who are in government, in the ministries, in the legislature, were people who held guns in the 1980s,
right,
who were underground, who were the object of, even as they were during the daytime, college professors or peasant leaders or students, at night they were guerrillas, you know, doing sabotage, recon, and combat work against the fascist government. Many of them had been targeted. You know, their covers had been blown eventually, and they were targeted for death by the death squads. And it was a very particular type of war because it wasn't just in the mountains. It was also on the streets and college campuses, one to the other. She was tortured, and the guerrillas immediately kidnapped a businessman so that they could be able to trade her and get her out of there before she broke. It was very dangerous work. I mean, if you were a guerrilla, your life expectancy was not going to be very long. The people of the FMLN now are the ones who were lucky to survive that war.
Yes, I'd say so. Just real quickly, is there opportunity for the U.S. here, for people of the left in the U.S.? It seems to me we could have a heck of a lot better relationship with Latin America.
Yeah, absolutely. It's all a matter of education, but it's also very important for progressives all over the U.S. to learn more about what is happening in Latin America. It's not the same panorama as in the Reagan 80s.
Right.
It's now more complex. Many of these people who were underground in the left are now in power and are facing, you know, a lot of unsatisfactory trade-offs involved with power. But it's mostly a matter of education. Right now, Latin America is not that big an item in U.S. foreign policy.
Right.
You see, the Middle East is getting all the headlines.
Oh, for sure.
And I would say it's all a matter of, you know, getting in touch with the grassroots organizations in Latin America, in Brazil, in Argentina, dealing with big issues like GMOs, GMO crops, and fights against resource extraction. And it is important not to be simplistic. You know, there are major natural resource struggles going on in countries with progressive governments, and it is a very difficult situation to mediate. It's very easy to say, for example, that the governments have sold out. That's a very easy conclusion to reach, or the opposite conclusion, that the environmentalists are part of a sinister plot of imperialism. Both interpretations are pretty popular, and they're both very simplistic. It's tons more complicated than that, and I'm really looking forward to spending an extended period in South America so that I can come back from there with a report straight from the field, just like George Orwell did during the Spanish Civil War.
Yes.
And be able to tell you firsthand how things are coming along.
Well, thank you very, very much. This is exceedingly informative here, and I wish you good luck, and we will keep in touch as things go along, and look forward to speaking with you again. Bert Cohen here. We've been talking with Carmelo Ruiz Marrero. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks very much for the opportunity.
And we'll hear just a little bit of Bruce Cockburn. Thanks very much for listening.
Back by the guns of Markham, military profiteers, whose word is a swamp and whose brow is smeared with the blood of the poor. Who rob life of its quality, who render rage a necessity, by turning countries into labor camps, modern slavers and dragons, champions of freedom. And cynical instrument who makes the gun into a sacrament. The only response to the deification of tyranny by so-called developed nations, idolatry of ideology. North, south, east, west, kill the best and buy the rest. It's just spend a buck to make a buck. You don't really give a flying fuck about the people in misery.